Afternoon docket. We have three cases set to today, but only one is for oral argument. My name's Dana Womack, and to my left is Justice Brian Walker, and to my right is Justice Mike Wallach. I'm going to ask the clerk to please call the case that's set for oral argument.
The court will now call McMahon Flooring Incorporated versus Shelly Morrison and Steve Howell. Goldberg will argue for the appellant. Mr. Antonio Allen will argue for the appellee.
Thank you. Mr. Goldberg, you may begin.
Justices Womack, Wallach, Walker, thank you for your time today. My name is Todd Goldberg, and I represent the appellant, McMahon Flooring, Inc., which I'll refer to as MFI. This employment dispute involves MFI and its former employees, Shelly Morrison and Steve Howe, who are now employed by MFI's direct competitor. The appeal specifically concerns the partial granting of a temporary injunction against the defendants that failed to maintain the status quo because the temporary injunction does not account for the non-competition and non-solicitation covenants in defendants' employment agreements. Following an evidentiary hearing in February of 2021, the trial court only enjoined defendants from using or disclosing MFI's confidential information and trade secrets, but the injunction order does not stop defendants from violating the non-competition and non-solicitation covenants that are in those agreements. The primary issue for the appeal is whether the trial court clearly abused its discretion by entering a temporary injunction that failed to maintain the status quo because the trial court did not enjoin defendants from engaging in competition in violation of the non-competition and non-solicitation covenants.
Counsel, before we get to the first question as you've described it, it seems to me like we have an issue as to whether or not this order is void. The agreement language, which the court adopted as part of its order, as the basis of its order, says it is therefore reasonable and necessary that MFI be accorded the equitable remedies of specific performance and injunctive relief without any requirement for a bond. Do you have any case authority that says that parties through an agreement can agree to waive the rule requirements for an injunction bond, which the court can then use as a basis for not having a bond?
I can get to the bonding issue. So the argument by appellee or cross appellant is that the bond, it's really not that there was no bond amount fixed, it's that the bond fixed was zero and that the bond is inadequate.
Even if that's their argument, if it's void, we can take it up sua sponte. And one of the concerns which I think this briefing presents is there's certainly a fair amount of case law out there that says that an injunction order without a bond is void. And that's a different question from is the order sufficient. And the trial court specifically said that based upon Section 23 of the Morrison Agreement and Section 8 of the Howe Agreement, that the bond is zero. The agreement didn't say we agree to zero bond. The agreement said we're waiving a bond.
Right.
Okay, and so my question is, do you have any authority that says that a trial court can rely upon the agreement of parties to waive a bond?
Not specific to that issue. I do have authority that basically states that a temporary injunction issued without a bond is void, but the failure to require a bond in a sufficient amount does not render an injunction void. So here, they rendered a bond of $0. There was an amount of bond rendered.
Well, was there a bond posted for $0?
There wasn't, and the argument there is that if the bond is $0 and the bond's whole purpose is to provide security for the injunction,
Rule 684 says you have to post the bond and have it approved by the district clerk, right?
Rule 684 does say that.
Okay.
And so my argument, though, is that it would just be a piece of paper that says we hereby file a bond of $0. So it would be a meaningless act, in essence.
Okay, go ahead.
Counselor, since we're jumping around,
sure.
And you'll have to apologize. I literally landed at 2:00 this morning at DFW. So I was looking through. One thing that jumped out at me was their claim that there was unclean hands because it's the name of the. It's not MFI, but it's the agent or entity. River Dean never actually paid. Mrs. Howe, I believe is her name, Mrs. Morrison, for what she sold. What's your position on that?
Well, that's I don't believe there's evidence of that in the actual record. That was just an argument that was made on appeal that I think they were trying to bootstrap an argument that wasn't actually argued. There was an employment agreement between Mrs. Morrison and MFI. There was never an employment agreement between River Dean and Mrs. Morrison. So there's no money was owed, is how I'd address that. And even if it was, I'm not sure that would, I don't think that would invalidate a non-compete or non-solicitation, non-disclosure agreement in its entirety. Perhaps it could be an argument for some kind of offset in the trial for damages.
Yep.
Shall I go back to the original arguments that I'm making, or would you like to discuss any of the other issues? Obviously, the court's read the briefing. Court, I believe, is probably familiar with the factual background. So I won't waste your time on that. Our first argument is that, and it's a fundamental issue of a temporary injunction, right? That the court on a temporary injunction is supposed to maintain the status quo. And here, the status quo would have been to continue to enforce the employment agreements, which the temporary restraining order actually did, which says they cannot compete, solicit, use our confidential information. The trial court did not do that. The trial court merely said, yes, you have MFI's trade secrets, you have their confidential information, you're working for a direct competitor, you're in a position to use it, but we're not even going to address the non-compete, we're not even going to address the non-solicit agreements, I'm just going to order that you can't use the confidential information. And to me, that destroyed the status quo, and I think that the Weed Eater case, which I've cited in the brief, is extremely on point here. You almost couldn't ask for a case to be closer on point. It's Weed Eater versus Dowling, 562 SW2D 898, and in that case, it's basically the identical circumstances, and the Houston Court of Appeals found that the trial court had abused its discretion by entering a temporary injunction that only enjoined a former employee from disclosing his former employer's confidential information, but that did not enforce the covenant not to compete. And that court concluded, and I think it's very applicable here, that even in the best of good faith, a former employee cannot prevent his knowledge of his former employer's confidential information from showing up in the work for a competitor. And the court found that prohibiting the defendant from using the plaintiff's trade secrets would be insufficient because the defendant would inevitably disclose his knowledge of the trade secrets if allowed to work in that same area. And that applies to purposeful acts and non-purposeful acts, right? You know, somebody can say, oh, I'm not going to disclose or I'm not going to use the information that I've gotten from my prior employer, and they could really mean that. But what the court held there is that basically that person was in a position where they would be using their knowledge that they had in their head, and it would be impossible to tell when they were using the confidential information and trade secrets and when they weren't. So it was an abuse of discretion to only find that they couldn't use the confidential information and trade secrets, but not to order that they couldn't compete. And in such circumstances, because of those factors, the only effective relief is to restrain the former employee from working for a direct competitor of the former employer in the same area. And that's what we're asking for here. And you've also got the Dallas Court of Appeals in the Rugen case, which is 864 SW 2D 548, which held that an injunction is appropriate when necessary to prohibit an employee from using confidential information of a former employer to solicit the former employer's customers. And, you know, I kind of skipped over the facts, but I think the facts are important here. Usually in a non-compete case, you don't have somebody caught with their hand in the cookie jar. A lot of times these cases are filed based on speculation and, you know, trying to prevent some act that they think might happen. Here you have Ms. Morrison, who's admittedly selling to the very same customers that she sold for her new employer that she sold while she was at MFI. And she's sending emails, or Mr. Howe is sending emails, I believe inadvertently, talking about these sales to each other. And, oh, you know, the companies stopped buying from MFI right after they left. We're not, you know, this is not mere surmise or guessing what happened here. This is actual competition in violation of the non-compete. And in Rugen, they didn't even have an enforceable non-compete. It was just a common law duty that you can't use your former employer's information for your own benefit or the benefit of your new employer. And so here we've got better facts, right? And the Rugen court found evidence that the employee possessed confidential information of the former employer and operated a firm in direct competition with the former employer. Therefore, the employee is in a position to use the former employer's confidential information, and under the circumstances, it is probable that the former employee will use information for his benefit and the detriment of the former employer. And they found, as a result, it was not an abuse of discretion to grant a temporary injunction prohibiting the former employee from soliciting his former employer's customers. And we're asking here, as in Weed Eater, Rugen, and their progeny, and I believe there's some Second Court of Appeals cases that have cited Weed Eater, and there's a Hernandez case from earlier this year that also cited one or both. And basically, they're for the premise that the trial court finds that the defendants possess the confidential information and trade secrets. They're working for a direct competitor, and they're in a position to use that confidential information, those trade secrets, to the detriment of their former employee. And here, like in Weed Eater, and better than in Rugen, defendants have employment agreements that are enforceable and valid, and they contain restrictive covenants. And at the hearing, the evidence established that Morrison and Howe, the defendants, had confidential information of MFI and trade secrets, and they were soliciting MFI's customers, and that absent an order from the court, they would continue to do so. The trial court found irreparable harm. The trial court found probable right to relief requested. But the order doesn't go far enough. It merely enforces the confidentiality clause in the agreement, and while entirely ignoring the non-competition, non-solicitation covenants. And it didn't find, for example, that they were unenforceable. It didn't say anything about the non-compete and the non-solicitation covenants at all. It simply ignored them. And to that extent, the trial court clearly failed to maintain the status quo and abused its discretion by not enjoining defendants from competing with MFI using MFI's own information, pricing, customer information that they had developed over time, and they were using that information to service the very same customers that they were servicing for MFI, but now for their new company. And they were in the process, they were not only depleting MFI's sales to those customers, they were destroying MFI's business goodwill with those customers and stealing those customers away from them. And we're asking for the court to overturn, in part, the temporary injunction, basically to give it teeth, to give it what the employment agreements themselves say that they need to do, which is Ms. Morrison can't compete for 24 months, and Mr. Howe cannot solicit customers for 12 months. And that would be preserving the status quo until a trial on the merits could be had. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Allen?
Thank you, Justices. Antonio Allen for the appellee in this case. First of all, Justice Wallach, you're absolutely right. There's no authority. Certainly, appellants don't cite any authority for the proposition that Rule 684 can be ignored.
Let me flip it on its head. You know, right now, we still live in a free country, and people are entitled to contract for what they want to contract for. And the purpose of a bond is to allocate risk. If the parties want to agree not to have that allocation of risk provided, if they do so by contract, why shouldn't they be allowed to contract that way?
Justice Wallach, I would say that so long as the legislature carved out an exemption in 684 that allows that to happen and allows for there to be a carve out or contract around that rule, then that would be fine. But that's not the case. Here, there is no carve out. There are some exemptions to Rule 84, but that's not one of them. So while I do understand that it's in the agreement, again, there's no carve out within the rule, and there's no case law that has granted or said that that's okay. It's okay.
So this is a case of first impression for us on that.
It would be, yes. Also, Justice Walker, you ask about the unclean hands, and I know appellant's counsel said that there was no, that was not discussed at the trial court level, but that's not true. At the TI hearing, there was testimony about Ms. Morrison not being paid for commissions that she was entitled to for selling blinds for the Riverdean Company. And that's important. And I know appellant's counsel didn't talk much about the Riverdean Company and why that's important to this case, but it is, and I'll talk about that. But both in terms of unclean hands, Ms. Morrison's contract, her employment contract, required that any changes to her contract in terms of her pay, that it be agreed upon by both parties. And in this case, it was unilaterally changed. She was unilaterally changed from being a salaried employee to being a commissioned employee. And that's important because part of what this case is about the fact that they don't want her selling blinds, and it was when she started selling blinds for a different company that is the root of this, is at the root of this case. Our position is that the trial court did not abuse its discretion by refusing to include an unwarranted injunction against Ms. Morrison and Mr. Howe from working for Star Window Coverings. The trial court could have reasonably determined that appellant failed to, one, demonstrate a likelihood of success on its underlying claims, and two, to show that absent the temporary injunction requested, it would suffer probable, imminent, and irreparable injury between now and trial. The McMahon Flooring Company sells and installs flooring and countertops and have been in business since 2009. MFI hired Ms. Morrison in February 2019 to sell flooring and countertops. Ms. Morrison was paid a salary initially. MFI and Ms. Morrison executed an agreement which said that Ms. Morrison would not compete with MFI and she would not solicit or try to take away MFI's customers that she sold MFI's goods and services to. MFI hired Mr. Howe in July 2019 to be a warehouse manager. They also executed an agreement, but Mr. Howe's agreement did not prevent Mr. Howe from working for a competitor. There was no non-compete. It only prevented Mr. Howe from soliciting or trying to take away MFI's customers that he sold MFI's goods and services to. In Mr. Howe's job, he did not sell anything during his employment with MFI. He worked in a warehouse. The Riverdean Shade Company was formed in 2018, and it had common ownership with MFI, namely Brandon McMahon, who was a shareholder in MFI and the sole manager for Riverdean. Riverdean sells and installs window coverings, blinds. McMahon assigned Mr. Howe to help set up Riverdean's warehouse and to eventually manage its inventory, which he did. Ms. Morrison, about a year into her employment contract, Ms. Morrison was instructed by Mr. McMahon to begin selling Riverdean's window coverings in addition to MFI's goods and services. So in addition to flooring and countertops. At the same time, Ms. Morrison's compensation structure at MFI was unilaterally changed from salary to commissions. She was told that she would be paid commissions from Riverdean for her sales of window coverings. Ms. Morrison did not sign any agreement with Riverdean. Ms. Morrison sold flooring to MFI's customers and sold window coverings to Riverdean's customers. Now, admittedly, there was some overlap between the two sets of customers. Ms. Morrison and Mr. Howe left MFI and Riverdean to go to work for Star Window Coverings. Star only sells window coverings, not flooring. Mr. Howe became a warehouse manager for Star, and Ms. Morrison became a salesperson. But Ms. Morrison did not sell flooring or countertops for Star. Now, Ms. Morrison began selling window coverings to some of the same customers she sold blinds to at Riverdean. Mr. Howe did not sell anything. He managed Star's warehouse and the delivery of window coverings to Star's customers. Now, as appellees argue in this cross appeal, in their cross appeal, it is appellee's position that the trial court abused its discretion by granting MFI any temporary injunction. However, appellees recognize that abuse of discretion does not exist if the trial court bases its decision on conflicting evidence and evidence reasonably supports its conclusion. It is clear from the record in this case that the trial court had ample evidence from which it could have reasonably concluded that MFI failed to demonstrate a likelihood of success on its underlying breach of contract claims and that it failed to show that it would suffer probable imminent irreparable injury between now and trial if it didn't receive a temporary injunction preventing Ms. Morrison and Mr. Howe from working for Star. The trial court could have reasonably concluded that Ms. Morrison did not breach her employment agreement by selling window coverings for Star because the trial court properly construed Ms. Morrison's agreement as not prohibiting her from doing so. Ms. Morrison's agreement specifically defines goods and services that MFI was in the business of selling and the goods and services that MFI wanted Ms. Morrison to sell, a definition that does not include window coverings or any term that could be reasonably construed to be window coverings. The preamble of Ms. Morrison's agreement specified that MFI was employing Ms. Morrison to sell MFI's goods and services, a defined term. The trial court could have reasonably looked to all of the words expressed in Ms. Morrison's agreement and determined that the intent of the parties when they executed Ms. Morrison's agreement was to restrict Ms. Morrison's ability to compete with MFI's business of selling, delivering, installing carpet pad, hard surface flooring, vinyl tile, carpet repairs, patching, stretching, flood restoration, relaying, deodorizing carpets, tile, and grout cleaning, countertop sales, countertop installation, countertop repairs, cabinet sales, sales and installations of tile backsplashes. These were the goods and services that the contracting parties expressly intended Ms. Morrison to sell while she was employed by MFI. And it is in that context that the court could have reasonably determined that neither the non-compete nor the non-solicitation provisions in paragraph 20 of her employment agreement were breached. Now, as the Texas Supreme Court said in Republic National Bank of Dallas versus Northwest National Bank of Fort Worth in 1978, in Texas, writing is generally construed most strictly against its author and in such a manner as to reach a reasonable result consistent with the apparent intent of the parties. The trial court certainly would not have misapplied the Texas Supreme Court's guidance in contract construction by strictly construing the employment agreement against MFI by reaching a reasonable result consistent with the intent of the parties as expressed by the employment agreement that Ms. Morrison's employment agreement does not prohibit her from selling window coverings. The trial court could have reasonably concluded that Mr. Howe did not breach his employment agreement by working for Star in their warehouse. Mr. Howe's agreement does not even include a provision preventing him from working for an MFI competitor. Mr. Howe's agreement prohibits him from directly or indirectly or in conjunction with or on behalf of any individual or entity solicit, divert, take away, or attempt to take away from MFI any customer, potential customer, or account for whom employee had responsibility or with whom he or she had direct contact with while at MFI. The evidence presented during the TI hearing demonstrated that Mr. Howe never sold anything for MFI or Riverdean, had no responsibility for MFI's or Riverdean's customers, and had no direct contact with MFI or Riverdean's customers beyond making deliveries.
Counselor, if that's true, then how did he get a hold of the list that he emailed on the day that he interviewed with the new employer?
Mr. Howe, the testimony at the TI hearing was that Mr. Howe emailed to himself a list of customers and addresses that he used to set up deliveries. So these were a list of apartment complexes. They weren't a list of the contacts who the salespeople sold to. This had no contact information for the person who was responsible for buying blinds. This was simply the locations of those customers where Riverdean was delivering blinds. So he emailed that to himself in order to work remotely. He was working remotely and he emailed it to himself so that he would have that list and be able to make those deliveries. Now, Mr. Howe also testified that he's never used that list for any purpose other than for the benefit of Riverdean. And in fact, the evidence and the testimony at the TI hearing was that same information was available from a publicly available database. And that database was called ALN. And not only did Mr. Howe and Ms. Morrison testify that they had that database available to them while they were at MFI, but they also had that database available to them when they went to Star window covering. And in fact, MFI's corporate representative also testified that they in fact did have access to this publicly available database, which included contact information, addresses for all of these customers that were on that customer list. So that information was available publicly. But whether it was available publicly or not, what Mr. Howe's testimony was that he used that to do his job. He used that list to do his job. He did not take that list with him when he left MFI. He no longer has it. And he had no need for it at Star window covering. The trial court could have reasonably concluded that MFI also failed to show that absent a temporary injunction, it would suffer probable, imminent, and irreparable injury between now and trial. The trial court found that a month before leaving for Star, Mr. Howe did email himself contact information of a list of customers. And as I just said, Mr. Howe's testimony at trial was that this list was sent in order for him to remotely do his job scheduling deliveries for Riverdean. There was no evidence presented to the court tying this list of customers to any activity by Ms. Morrison or Mr. Howe at Star. In fact, the undisputed testimony and evidence demonstrated that the same information was accessible from a publicly available database, like I just talked about, ALN. The court could have reasonably concluded that because the information Mr. Howe emailed himself was also available through ALN, and there was no evidence presented during evidence presented demonstrating that Ms. Morrison and Mr. Howe used or disclosed MFI's confidential information, MFI failed to show that absent a temporary injunction, it would suffer probable or imminent and irreparable injury. An injunction, as the Texas Court of Appeals, Fort Worth Texas Court of Appeals has said, an injunction is not proper when the claim injured is merely speculative. Fear and apprehension of injury are not sufficient to support a temporary injunction. And the weed eater case that appellant discusses, is not applicable here. Because there was no evidence in that case that the information sought to be protected was publicly available. Furthermore, in the weed eater case, there was a non-compete provision preventing the former employee from working in employment closely related to the field of activity as an employee of Weed Eater, which the court found was violated. In the case at bar, there are two different employee contracts at issue. Ms. Morrison's contract includes a non-compete and non-solicitation provision, but those provisions do not prevent her from selling window coverings. Mr. Howe's contract does not include a non-compete, and while it does include a non-solicitation provision, the undisputed evidence in this case, in the record in this case, proves that he did not solicit customers for MFI or Riverdean. And he does not solicit customers for Star window covering. He works in the warehouse. There was no finding by the trial court that Ms. Morrison violated her non-compete with MFI or that Ms. Morrison took, disclosed, or used MFI's confidential information. There was no finding by the trial court that Mr. Howe disclosed or used MFI's confidential information. The trial court only found that Mr. Howe emailed himself customer addresses and phone numbers prior to his departure. However, Mr. Howe testified that the information was used only for the benefit of Riverdean. Furthermore, the evidence in the record establishes that the information emailed was only customer addresses, not phone numbers. So the trial court got that wrong. In addition, there was no evidence in the record establishing any link between the information emailed and the activities of either Mr. Howe or Ms. Morrison on behalf of their new employer. Therefore, the trial court's decision not to grant any additional restrictions in its temporary injunction was reasonable and supported by the evidence presented during the temporary injunction hearing.
Before you're out of time, I wanted to ask one question. The order you're appealing for from the order granting the application for temporary injunction set this matter for trial on the merits on August the 23rd of 2021. Could you tell me what the current status is? Did that go to trial or what happened?
It did not go to trial, Your Honor. It was actually we were reset. I don't remember the date that we've been reset, but the trial has not occurred.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justice.
Mr. Goldberg?
Thank
address a few of the items that were argued there. Obviously, we don't agree. You heard a lot of the court could have found this, the court could have found that, the court could have interpreted this or that. When you look at the order, though, the court, in fact, did find that MFI would suffer irreparable injury. The court did find a probable right to relief on behalf of MFI. So to argue what the court could have found goes against what the court did in fact find in the order. In addition, Mr. Allen read the long-winded, not solicit directly or indirectly or in conjunction with in Mr. Howe's non-solicitation agreement, which I think is important for the court to understand. The non-solicitation provision didn't just prevent Mr. Howe from going out and making sales. It also prohibited him from indirectly participating in those sales, which is what he did. He was supporting Ms. Morrison in making her sales to MFI's customers for a direct competitor. The list that he emailed to himself contained 139 customers. So the argument that he sent it to himself so he would know the addresses of the customers for him to make deliveries that day, to me, rings hollow. I'm not sure Superman can deliver to 139 customers in a single day. Obviously, his testimony on the issue, which the trial court weighed, could clearly be found to be self-serving in this instance, right? And in fact, there was a direct link. There was a direct link between that list and Mrs. Morrison's activities. There were, I want to say, five customers that were on that list that Mrs. Morrison then started selling products to Four Star. So that's a direct link. You find the customer's name on the list, and she took them from MFI to Star. You can't get more direct than that. I don't know that we've really discussed standing all that much today. I think it's clear that a former employer has standing to sue its former employees based on an employment agreement with those employees. I don't think that's really an issue. Likewise, a former employer has standing to sue for tortious conduct and similar employment claims. There is ample evidence in the record of improper disclosure and use of the information. Ms. Morrison knew MFI's prices, and she was able to go sell to MFI's customers with the knowledge in her head of MFI's prices on behalf of Star. Obviously, knowing those prices gives you a significant competitive advantage that's unlawful. That's what these agreements are designed to protect against, exactly that type of conduct. And if you want to get specific, Service One, Camden Farmers Market, Tangential Services, which is also called TSI in Wellington at Willabend, that's four customers that were on that list, and Ms. Morrison stole them from MFI using MFI's information, and she had worked for servicing them for MFI. We have an argument, too, that we actually worked for River Dean's, and we were selling River Dean's products to River Dean's customers, and nothing in the record actually supports that. We're playing a shell game with an entity here. These employees were always employed by MFI. They got their paychecks from MFI, their W-2s from MFI. All this is in the record. They were clearly employees of MFI selling a certain product. It would be similar as if they were selling some international, like Bohawk, or an international brand of flooring. They sold River Dean's products. It's not that confusing. They never thought that they were employed by River Dean until this lawsuit came about, and they got cute. And finally, I'd say that that parties are in the state of Texas, they're allowed to agree to just about anything. And here they agreed that no bond would be required. And We are asking that the court honor that agreement in upholding the temporary injunction and not just simply saying, okay, well, the agreement said you didn't have to pay any bond. The court ordered $0, and you didn't file a piece of paper that said $0, so you don't get a temporary injunction. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your arguments. They're always very helpful to us, and your case has now been submitted, and you're excused. Thank you.
Thank you.